Welcome to Eat Feed, the podcast that takes you back in time, across the country, around the world, and back to your own table. I'm Ann Bramley. Each week of each month on the show, we talk about food and cooking from a new perspective, and you can find out more about upcoming shows, featured guests, the Eat Feed Manifesto, and everything else you ever wanted to know about the podcast on our website, eatfeed.com. We've just launched a new website with many new elements to give listeners a chance to get involved in both shaping the show and showing off their own food talents. On upcoming shows, I'll highlight the various things we've put in place. This week, I thought I'd mention the forum, though we're still working out a few technical glitches. We wanted to create a space where you could talk to food-minded friends, find recipes, brag about your own culinary accomplishments, and more. The idea is that food is communal, and it needs to be shared in a communal context. So, drop by, register, and add your voice to the conversation. And now for the show. Since it's the fifth week of March, we've stepped beyond our usual calendar, so we've decided to focus on the idea of eating and drinking to save the world. We'll talk with guests who are working on that idea, using a variety of approaches from around the world, from California to Grenada to Africa. Today's show topic is so big and so important that really we could have had any of the thousands and thousands of chefs, farmers, manufacturers, writers, restaurant owners, and more, who in both large and small ways take steps to save the world through what we eat and drink. Before getting to the three experts we have chosen, I just want to return for a moment to a previous show from a few weeks ago in Ireland. If you heard that show, you remember Sally Barnes, who produces handcrafted smoked salmon from Woodcock Smokery in County Cork. This week I was lucky enough to receive a gift from Sally, a lovely piece of that salmon. Eating it, just as she directed on the show, with brown bread, Irish butter, and a little pepper, was a transcendent experience. Really like no other smoked salmon I have ever had. It's not really even in the same food family as those vacuum-packed slivers from the grocery store. And I mention it here not just because I always love talking about the wonderful food gifts friends send, and not just because I think food really is the best gift, but because the ways that small producers like Woodcock Smokery play an important role in making a global impact through food. First, Sally starts with wild salmon, and that is unlike most smoked salmon you'll find in a typical U.S. grocery store, which begins with farm salmon. Second, there are no artificial preservatives. It's done purely with the magic of salt and smoke, and the intensive labor of a few individuals who get the fish from the sea to smokery and out into the world. This is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of what makes Woodcock Smokery salmon both politically important and gastronomically supreme, though. I've re-included the link to more info about Sally Barnes and Woodcock Smokery and her work on today's show synopsis page if you want to find out more. And now, on with the show. Chris O'Brien is the host of the website BeerActivist.com, on which he says, "My two great needs in life are drinking beer and saving the planet." Around those two needs, he's developed not only a website, but an entire movement designed to raise drinkers' awareness around one of the world's favorite brews. I caught up with him recently in South Africa on a stop at the Zululand Brewery as part of a tour he's undertaken to expand our knowledge of the indigenous beers in Africa. Could you first just give us a little introduction to your work and tell us a little bit about the projects that you're involved with?
My professional background is actually in green business. I ran two trade associations, one of specifically fair trade businesses, the kinds of businesses that most consumers would know for the coffee that they sell, fair trade coffee, companies like Equal Exchange, for example. I ran an organization called the Fair Trade Federation, which was the trade association that housed all of those kinds of companies. The other organization was called the Co-op America Business Network, which was a more broad umbrella type of group that embraced all kinds of different businesses that were engaged in business to change the world. About a little over a year ago, I made the decision to dedicate myself full-time to drinking beer and saving the world. And I quit my job, sold my house in Washington, D.C., and moved with my partner to Ethiopia, and have since been focused on the project of completing a book that I've been tentatively titling The Beer Activist Guide to Saving the World. I support that with a monthly e-brews letter at beeractivist.com. But the other business I'm involved in that relates to this is called the Seven Bridges Organic Homebrew Cooperative. And it's a cooperatively owned company that retails only 100% certified organic homebrew supplies, as well as fair trade and organic home coffee roasting supplies, which is actually a very quickly growing niche in America. People are, just like they want to make beer at home, people are now finding that they want to make their own coffee so that it's really fresh, and they know that they can get it fair trade and organic, so they're they know that what they're doing is not just a high quality tasting experience for themselves, but that it also has positive ramifications throughout the supply chain.
Obviously, this week's show is called Eating and Drinking to Save the World, and we had you on because, as you just said, you very much believe that better beer can save the world. How exactly is that?
Well, better beer, in the way that I use the term, means beer that is more than a commodity. After Prohibition in the U.S., beer became dominated by a handful of companies, and it became really nothing more than a commodity. It became much more of the companies that made beer became much more of marketing companies than they were actual brewing companies. And that was part of a trend throughout industry in general, but particularly in food in the U.S. Companies that made food that might have one time had a more cultural base in terms of its production and consumption moved to become solely an industry where it was a product to be sold for profit. And what's happened in the U.S. is that beer has become something more than a product again. It's become something that is part of life rather than just something that's sold to make money for a few companies. A good example of that is that by the late 70s, there were fewer than 50 brewing companies left in the United States, and only a handful of those 50 dominated most of the market. In 25 years since then, we've ramped back up to 1,500 breweries in the U.S., almost all of which are what's classified as a craft brewery, which means a company that makes high-quality beer and in very small, handcrafted batches. To me, what that symbolizes is the move on the part of consumers, instead of being merely a consumer, to being an active citizen who engages in an experience of eating or drinking that is more than a mere purchase of a commodity. With beer, what that means is, if you trace it through the ages, beer was always rooted in the community, rooted in celebrations that were important to the community. It was always made by women in the home throughout all of history until only the recent few hundred years. And that's in the last 25 years, that's changed. It's coming back. It's full circle where it's being made in the home again. It's being made out of tradition and culture rather than as an entrepreneurial endeavor to make profit.
As you say, beer has really become a part of life now, and in the past couple decades, certainly the whole beer movement has taken off in this country and really changed the way that people buy and drink beer. And this interest seems to have affected the restaurant world as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how Top Chefs are hosting beer dinners and helping diners learn about pairing quality beers with gourmet food?
Sure. One of the things that happened when beer became a commodity was that it lost all of its diversity, and companies that made it looked for ways to make it in the cheapest way and still be able to call it beer. So they eliminated all of the diversity in the product and in order to settle on the kind of lowest common denominator type product that appealed to the broadest market. When they did that, it became a product that didn't have quite as much of a rich contribution to an eating experience because you were left with a very bland, fizzy, watered-down product that didn't have a lot of flavor left in it. But now most beer critics agree the U.S. is actually the world beer center today, not just in terms of production or consumption, but in terms of the diversity and quality of our beers. And what chefs are realizing is that this is a great opportunity to introduce customers to new ways of experiencing their meals. One of the things that's really nice about beer is that, for one thing, because it's carbonated, at least usually it is, the carbonation scrubs the top of your palate clean. So when you take a bite of cheese, for example, and then have a mouthful of beer, those carbonation bubbles actually clean your palate so that when you taste something else, you're tasting the full flavor of the next morsel. Chefs are taking advantage of this and realizing that their food can actually be complemented with many different kinds of beer. So people like Garrett Oliver is one of the guys in the beer movement who has been championing beer-food pairings. He wrote a book maybe two or three years ago called The Brewmaster's Table, and it's actually become a really popular book. It's not the only one of its kind. It's actually part of a whole number of books that are coming out like this, but this is one that's been popularly read by chefs learning, because chefs are just learning this too. The beers haven't been available for very long, so it's a learning curve for everyone. People are learning that they can actually offer, you know, a dinner to the customers that's a special dinner, not just where the server recommends to you what kind of beer you might want to have with what part of your meal, but where you can actually go to a restaurant and sit down and pay a set price for a set course with a tutor leading the dinner, explaining to you what this beer is all about, where it comes from, who makes it, why the flavor characteristics of this beer match the southern catfish that you're eating with it, et cetera, et cetera. So this is something that, as a consumer, it's an opportunity to go out and support good local restaurants while having a completely different tasting experience than what you're used to. So it's a lot of fun for people.
So what are some of the better beers that you would personally recommend tasting?
What I normally recommend depends on the time of the day, where I am, my mood. And so what I tell people is, wherever you are, first of all, look for what's locally made. Because if it's local, it's bound to be fresher. Fresher beer has more flavor in it. It also, by choosing a locally produced product, you're reducing the environmental impact that you're having, which I haven't said much about, and that's a whole part of the story about how beer is saving the world. It's a very ecologically sustainable industry, and it's pioneering new ways of being ecologically sustainable. There are a number of breweries that have actually become zero waste. But yeah, so look for what's local and what's fresh, and then just decide what fits the moment. And usually that's going to be the best beer.
To give an overview, how would you define a socially responsible beer? What should we be looking at when we go, if we don't have a specific beer in mind, but we go to the store and we're looking for a beer, how can we, you know, figure out if this is a good one to buy or not in terms of the kind of criteria that you've been talking about?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, you know that when you buy a locally made beer, you're already making a significant choice as a consumer to support a business that's local. What supporting a local business means is that a local dollar circulates, and now I'm gonna quote from memory, and I could be wrong on this, but I want to say that there's an equation that shows that a locally invested dollar circulates something like 8.2 times or something, and what that means is that you're creating local wealth. So rather than sending wealth out of your community, typically into highly paid executives' salary, instead you're paying someone who works locally and who's then going to spend their money locally, and the circle continues. So just by choosing local, you're already making a significant choice as a conscientious consumer. But beyond that, look for organic. There are a number of organic beers out there, and again, it's the small craft breweries that are pioneering organic brewing. Woolivers is a nationally available brand that has, I think they have six different beers now. I've toured their facility up in Brattleboro, Vermont. They're even going a step further by buying some of their ingredients locally. They buy locally produced wheat. They buy some berries that are grown locally in Vermont. There are a couple other organic breweries. Most of them are regional. There are other beers that are available from companies that power their plants with wind power. New Belgium is a good example of that in Colorado. I think they're nationally available now. And they have a deep commitment to environmental practices. They've actually pioneered some processes in their brewery that they treat the wastewater from their brewery before it even gets to the public sanitation system, so that they're actually reducing the cost for the taxpayer by cleaning when the water that comes out of their brewery is clean enough to drink. And they do that because they want to be a good citizen, and they don't want to put that burden on the local taxpayer. There are a few beers in the world that use certified fair trade ingredients. This is something that is not available in the U.S. yet. A couple brewers in Britain are doing it. There's one in Belgium that's doing it. But that's something to look for. I think we're right around the corner probably from having a beer in the U.S. that has a certified fair trade ingredient in it. Those are the kind of principles that I would use when I go into the store to buy a beer that when I want to know that it's making a difference.
Because we do have listeners in 30 different countries right now, can you give some recommendations for beer that meet the socially responsible criteria, say in England and Canada at least, or any other sort of European countries?
Sure. In Canada, there's a great brewery. Again, this is very, because the nature of the kind of social change that I'm that I'm talking about, because the nature of it is very localized, a lot of the examples that I give are going to be local examples. One in Canada is called Crannog Ales, Crannog. I think the website is crannogales.com, crannogales.com. They're a brewery that is very close to zero waste. They're what's called a farmhouse brewery. They grow most of their ingredients, and they only distribute in bulk containers, so either in kegs or in what people call growlers. A growler, when you go into a brew pub and you want to take some of the beer home with you, you get what a brew pub calls a growler, which is just a large glass container that's refillable. And that's another one of the little innovations that craft brewers have made, is that instead of getting a pack of bottles that you're either going to throw out or recycle, if you're lucky, they might get recycled. But even recycling takes energy. And rather than recycling, most brew pubs, you can carry this big glass container in and fill it up. There are actually a much greater number of organic beers in Britain than there are in the U.S., and actually, I list most of these beers on my website at beeractivist.com. There's a page where you can go that has a directory of beers from around the world, and it shows you why they made my directory. It's either because they're organic or because they're independent or they're taking some other kind of environmentally conscientious steps in their production. But one of the ones in England is called Charles, the name is slipping my mind right now, but they make a beer, a very unique beer called banana bread beer, and it actually uses fair trade organic bananas, and it tastes great, actually. It sounds funky, but it tastes delicious. The big one in the UK is Golden Promise, is a beer that was the first certified organic beer in Britain, and it started the trend in Britain of organic beers, and that's widely available in the UK. Most of the co-op stores in the UK carry organic beer. Some of them they even have as house beers. In the UK, organic beer has taken off much earlier in greater volume than it has reached in the U.S. So, and that's true in most of Europe, actually. Germany has a good selection of organic beers. Pinkus is a good example in Germany. Belgium has a number of organics. And, another one. And just Sam Smith's in the U.K., which is a classic beer, made a decision early on to convert to organic ingredients. And that's an award-winning beer that people who are beer conscious would grab a Sam Smith's because they know that it's an excellent beer, and it does happen to be organic now because they made the decision to go organic. So when big, high-quality names like that are doing it, you know it's leading the trend. In Europe and in America, you'll see more and more of them.
How can people learn more about how to become what you call a beer activist?
Go to my website, www.beeractivist.com. I have a newsletter that's free monthly newsletter that highlights what different beers are doing to change the world and how you as a beer drinker can have fun drinking them responsibly and know that you're making an impact. It's pretty easy. Just go and sign up. Use the directory that's on the website to find beers that are available in your area and have fun.
Yeah, like my ale, like my style. Do I have to tell you, brother, what life's all about? I got amber, dark, and oatmeal stout. Well, I'm a home brewery, I'm making inserts. I whip it all up in a 5-gallon jug. Ferment it, bottle it, put it in a mug.
Mutt Green founded and runs Grenada Chocolate, a small chocolate producer in Grenada, transforming his love for a country and a food into a business. From how the cocoa is grown, to how it's transformed into gourmet chocolate bars, to how it's distributed, he considers how every aspect of the business interacts with the idea of how to eat to save the world. I had the chance to talk to him about his unique undertaking from his business in Grenada. How would you describe Grenada Chocolate and the philosophy behind it?
The Grenada Chocolate Company is the result of a dream that I had for many years while I lived in Grenada in a little bamboo house that I built on a mountainside, mostly growing food, and I became fascinated with the cocoa tree, and for years had this dream of manufacturing fine dark chocolate here in Grenada. Cocoa is one of the big crops in Grenada, but over the years that I've been here, I've really seen it decline, and it's kind of a strange thing because it's one of the best quality cocoas in the world, think it's the second most expensive cocoa in the world, and yet the country just really wasn't making ends meet as a cocoa exporter. Economy of scale and other producers of very fine cocoa in this region were producing much more, and the price that farmers were getting paid for their cocoa was going down and down to the point where people weren't really even picking their cocoa much, and it was becoming almost a forgotten crop. And I figured a way to revolutionize chocolate making in the world in general, really, and certainly in Grenada, as a great example, would be to actually manufacture a finished, fine, dark chocolate of the highest quality in the world, like some of the French and other European chocolates, with the cocoa in Grenada, which is of suitable quality, right in Grenada, so as to help the economy of the cocoa-producing country itself the most. That is making jobs here, encouraging tourism because we make chocolate here, and then, in general, being able to export a value-added product so much greater in value than the cocoa beans itself. So I had this dream for quite a number of years until 1998, when a partner, friend of mine from the United States, became my partner, and we managed to get a kind of startup research loan, which took us for several years until 2001, researching, figuring out how to make chocolate on a small scale, which turned out to be pretty involved. The philosophy of the company now is just to include only Grenadians, aside from the two. We have three directors. One's a Grenadian national, my old friend from this village, and then there's my partner Doug from the United States and myself. And we run the business as a cooperative, and the idea is that all the people involved to be Grenadians and to do equal salaries, and the overall principle being that cocoa producers themselves, farmers, indeed should benefit as much from the production of this chocolate as the chocolate makers and the other people who sell the chocolate along the line. And we can assure that because we operate our own cocoa farms now, which we've certified organic, and the crew that grows the cocoa is really one with the people that make the chocolate. It's actually through a partnership between the cocoa farm management and the chocolate factory.
So it sounds like from every perspective of the business, really, from the product, the raw material, the labor practices, the location, the environmental implications, that you really do fit into this week's show's theme, which is eating and drinking to save the world. So do you see yourself as a pioneer or as someone who is trying to help save the world through food?
Well, you know, I guess you just save one little tiny sector of the world at a time, you know, but I definitely, yes, see what we're doing as pioneer work in the chocolate industry, and it's interesting because we're kind of riding a wave here as well with the recent publicity over the last few years of the health benefits of dark chocolate and the increased interest in dark chocolate in parts of the world which previously weren't particularly the dark chocolate, like the United States and the UK. And then also, probably more importantly, the political consciousness is certainly coming into the mainstream with regard to chocolate the last couple of years. People have become aware of deplorable, exploitative conditions in West Africa, where 90% of the cocoa is produced, up into and, including child slave labor complaints. And generally, it's a very exploitive crop. And I would say chocolate is a good sort of working example and perhaps a symbol even of saving the world through food, really, because chocolate is said to be the world's favorite food, and yet it's one of the most exploitive foods. I guess coffee got famous for that, too, but it's grown in places that it's grown in the tropics and requires tremendous amounts of labor. And the kind of countries that it's often grown in are not very rich to start with. People tend to be exploited. The world's appetite for chocolate's grown so much that tremendous amounts of cocoa is really pushed into West Africa and some of Asia, and a lot of exploited people. Now, there's definitely a fair trade chocolate movement, and I think everybody in the fair trade chocolate movement is doing their part to save the chocolate eating world, especially the producers for the chocolate eating world. I like to think that other people will follow what we do, because I think we are kind of pioneering a different approach to that fair trade in chocolate production and cocoa farming, because generally fair trade cocoa means that the cocoa price is higher, and then the cocoa is still exported to whatever country that has the technology and, some fancy jobs and a boost to the economy in that country, and then the product to make that country proud is produced, which is, better than buying cocoa at exploitive prices, indeed. But what we're doing is to revolutionize that by actually producing the finished chocolate right here where the cocoa grows with the same people and exporting it as a fine chocolate.
Well, that was going to be, you've already answered my next question, which was going to be to get you to talk a little bit about the fact that you are fairly singular in this practice that, well, first of all, you're not in Africa, and it's not a huge exploitive plantation, and that you're actually transforming the raw materials into the finished product sort of all in one location. That makes you fairly different from other chocolate producers, yes?
Yes, there are one or two examples of companies that do produce chocolate in the same country that the cocoa is grown, but the ones that I know of are on very large scale, industrial, and not a really great connection or anything between the cocoa producers and the chocolate makers. So what we really have here is a unique thing in that it's one group of people really growing the cocoa and producing the chocolate, and we do it on a very small scale. We're going to try to grow as we go, but we're probably the smallest chocolate company in the world, which enabled us to really be able to do this experiment of producing chocolate in an environment. Probably in most countries that produce chocolate in the same country that the cocoa grows, like that as well. For example, they bring the cocoa to a different part of the country. That's where it's easier because the infrastructure is better and even the environmental conditions are better. It's actually quite a challenge to make chocolate here in the tropics, in the same place where the cocoa grows because of the humidity. However, it's certainly possible, and I think that's the ultimate way to assure that the people that are actually working hard growing the cocoa and have worked hard over the years planting the cocoa get the maximum benefit, since they are really doing the most important part for a finished, the least quality chocolate bar, where cocoa beans are the main ingredient.
By doing this, I'm wondering, is part of the benefit also that you have a little bit more control over the quality of the finished product?
Yes, excellent question. I don't know if you're aware of this, but chocolate is a fermented food. Cocoa beans come out of a pod that they grow in on a cocoa tree as a fruit, white, sticky fruit, pulpy, with the seeds embedded inside. And that pulp, together with the seeds, are fermented for a number of days. And it's a real, true fermentation process. Sugars turn to alcohol. The alcohols impart flavors inside the cocoa and then get used up and turn into vinegar and drain off. And you don't end up with alcohol in the cocoa, but the chocolate flavor and all the flavors that we want in cocoa beans to make chocolate or cocoa powder are the result of fermentation. And that fermentation is crucial. It's just as crucial as with fermenting grapes to make wine in terms of the final flavor. Now, cocoa has to be fermented right on the cocoa farm. So most cocoa in the world is actually fermented either by a government organization or by the farm itself, and then from there exported. And the companies that aren't in immediate cocoa-growing areas tend to have very little control, if any at all, over the way that it's fermented. They might make requests and even have workshops, but the fact of the matter is people will ferment it in whatever is easier and whatever they feel to be the best way, because the manufacturer is really not around. So, of course, since we get to ferment and dry our own cocoa, it's tremendous. It gives us a chance to do a kind of research that most chocolate companies can't do. We can simply try different fermentations. More of an art than a science. Science knows what's going on, but why different amounts of fermentation, number of days and so on, cause different flavors and for different cocos in different areas is a mystery. And the only way to figure it out is to try different fermentation regimes, different number of days in the fermentation box, that is, before it dries, and then make a finished chocolate with it and see which you like the best.
One of the things that is particularly interesting about your production methods, I think, is the machinery and your power sources. I would love to hear more about that, if you could say a little bit more.
Small-scale chocolate making is very rare. When we first did start doing our research about how to make chocolate, I ended up visiting first a very large chocolate plant in the United States. And what I learned right away from that and a couple other experiences is that you can't actually acquire small-scale chocolate machines very easily. They aren't really manufactured, because chocolate these days is generally produced in very, very large factories. And then that chocolate is sold to smaller chocolate companies in bulk, who melt it down and make other things. So this conversion of actual cocoa beans into chocolate on a small scale is so rare that we couldn't really find machines. In fact, at the beginning, after getting a little frustrated about that, we set out to make all our own machines. And we made our own cocoa roasters and mixers and grinders and a tempering kettle and cocoa butter presses. And then we spent about 3 years doing this research. And along the way, we met people and learned things and found out about the existence of some antique machines that have really helped us as well. So we ended up finding an antique grinding machine called the Melanger from Germany and several other antique machines, all of which we refurbished ourselves and converted to run on solar power because we were building this factory to be solar powered. And some of our homemade machines we used for many years, like our roaster. Other ones we still use and probably always will use, like our homemade cocoa butter pressing. Cocoa butter pressing, incidentally, is a interesting and important part of chocolate making. It's the separation of the cocoa butter fat with the solids in some cocoa. And then that fat is actually mixed with a different set of cocoa, fresh beans, and sugar to make chocolate. And as a result of squeezing that fat out of some cocoa, you end up with cocoa powder. So it's kind of separation between the fat and the powder. And we could have imported our cocoa butter, but we really didn't want to since we're on the little island and we wanted our product to be 100% Grenada cocoa product. But cocoa butter presses are machines that antiques are not. They just don't exist on the small scale. And we spent quite a bit of time designing our own cocoa butter presses, which we continue to use over the years. We've modified them and improved them a little. They're hand-operated using a regular hydraulic jack, and they're very simple. One of the principles of doing technological work like this in a place like Grenada, which is a little island in the sea where parts aren't particularly accessible and sometimes a certain amount of time has to be waited to import parts and so on, is to try to make things very solid and as simple as possible so that we can keep repairing them ourselves. And that's quite a challenge with chocolate making because there's so many different machines. There's 5 or 6 machines involved in every batch of chocolate. But we do have things fairly simple and easy to maintain.
So I imagine many people not only admire the work that you're doing, but they also probably envy you. What is it that you love most about your job?
Well, I guess what I love most about it is that it's a really interesting and fun combination of tinkering, kind of mad scientist engineering, using things built for other things, for our own purpose, and making things from scratch and so on. And it's all of that sort of part of the brain combined with a real culinary sort of art, you know, making a confection, you could call it, a dark chocolate as nice as we can make it. And it's really, really where the two meet. There's really, depending upon the actual mechanical design of a certain machine, for example, you can affect the final taste of the chocolate. So for me, it's fun to be able to combine both interests that way. And
so if I could just ask you one final question. For if listeners are interested in purchasing Grenada chocolate bars, do you guys distribute around the world, or what is the best way to get a hold of them?
Grenada chocolate, by the way, is in general very scarce. Even before Hurricane Ivan, which was September 7th last year, we couldn't make nearly enough chocolate for the demand, and probably about 80% of our chocolate sells right here in Grenada. So the main way people eat chocolate so far, Grenada chocolate, has actually come to Grenada, and not that they necessarily come just for that. We were exporting a certain amount of chocolate, and we will continue to do that as our cocoa stocks build up again. The amazing thing, by the way, about Hurricane Ivan is that it destroyed a lot of the crops in Grenada. It didn't really hurt our cocoa farm particularly much. It just delayed this harvest. So we've got a lot of cocoa on the trees, and we're going to be harvesting that around the summertime, and by that time ramp up to full production. Right now we're in a bit low production, so there's less chocolate in general. We do have a few basic export avenues, though, which are good to know about. On our website, GrenadaChocolate.com, there's links to a web distributor that handles our chocolate, one in the United States and another web distributor in the UK. And that's a good place to get it in, a way to get it either in Europe or the United States, buying it online, having it sent to you by our distributor. That was the only real way we could do wide distribution because we can't send chocolate in small quantities away from Grenada. It's prohibitive. Other than that, there are two fairly prominent retail stores right now that carry our chocolate. One of them's in New York City called Commodities on 1st Avenue and 10th Street. And there is a specialty dark chocolate shop in the UK called Rococo Chocolates, R-O-C-O-C-O, in Chelsea, 321 Kings Road in Chelsea. They have another shop in Marylebone High Street, both in London. And those are the only places to get Grenada chocolate, except for in Grenada, until we expand, which we're trying to do. But certainly it's going to take a little while.
Christopher Schein runs Wild Heart Gardens, but like our other guests, he has his hands in many, many pots, thinking about how to save the world and what we eat from multiple perspectives and through multiple projects. Also, like the other guests on this week's show, he takes a holistic approach, thinking about issues related to the community and the environment, as well as aesthetics and function. He took time out from all the projects he's involved in the Bay Area in California to talk about several local movements that have global implications. I know that you're involved in several different projects, so before I get into the work at Wild Heart Gardens, could you explain a little bit about the Bay Area Seed Interchange Library and what you do with that?
Sure. About 7 years ago, we got together to come up with a way to make seeds available. I've been a community gardener for the past 13 years or so in Oakland, in Berkeley, and free seeds to community gardeners and school gardens and homeless garden projects and just backyard garden projects is kind of always a limiting factor. And part of it was in reaction to the genetic engineering that's overtaking our food supply system. So we're very scared to learn about the Terminator technology that the U.S. Department of Agriculture and private companies have come up with. And one of the best ways to ensure democracy of seed saving is having more local people know about how to save seeds. And it's a link that's been lost with current folks, that people don't even know how to grow their own food, and so they don't know how to save seeds. And so it seemed real important for us to get people connected with where their food comes from and to develop a local, regionally adapted seed network. And so that's where basil came out of. So we're really trying to adapt varieties of seeds to our different microclimates of the Bay Area, because most of the seeds currently are grown in Japan or in eastern Oregon or in Europe, a commercial seed industry, and just different climates that really don't reflect where we grow with our rainfall patterns and microclimates and drought, you know, 6 months of drought every year and all that stuff. So it's really important to get the seeds grown every year in our season and our climate, so we have stronger, better producing seeds that know our soils and climate. You know, there's some interesting facts about genetic erosion. That's another thing that we're really big on, is the heirlooms, because our grandparents and great-grandparents generations had something like 95% more diversity of seeds than we do. We're just at this bottleneck because of the corporate agriculture. We've really lost out a whole bunch on what kinds of seeds we have, so it's definitely getting into our roots.
If you could choose a seed that you'd really like to sort of highlight and encourage people to grow right now, I mean, I realize they're all sort of interwoven and important in their own way, but if there were sort of one or two varieties that you'd really like to see take off in your area, what would they be?
That's a really good question. I'm really into perennials, so just in my own landscaping business, I like to grow all these fun things like a yacon, which is a Bolivian sunroot. It's a perennial sunflower, so you just grow that one from tuber, so you don't even grow it from seed, but that's a great one. I just dug one up from my yard the other day for my permaculture class, and we weighed it, and it was 30 pounds of tuber, so they're like a jicama, so that was a really productive, that was a really fun one. For people who are starting out with seed saving, tomatoes, beans, and lettuces are all self-fertile, so they're really easy to save seed on, so it'd be really great if we had better tomato varieties, so things that are going to be adapted to our cooler season by just growing them out year after year is a really good thing. And we can get some lettuces that are going to be more resistant to slugs if we grow more lettuce that, you know, if you had 10 lettuce plants and one of them seemed like a little less eaten by the slugs and snails, then that would be a really great one to pick. I like the speckled. It's just a really pretty green lettuce with red speckles on it. That seems like a really nice variety.
Can you tell us a little bit about Wild Heart Gardens, which is really your bigger project, or I guess it's sort of the focus of your work, out of which the other things radiate?
For about the last 7 years, I've been doing my own self-employed landscaping business, and it's a permaculture-based business. And so I do natives and edibles, and so I either landscape folks' yards with local native plants, shrubs and trees and flowers and whatnot, for habitat gardens, really, and for drought-tolerant gardens, so we don't have to water them, so that's a big issue. And so I really dislike lawns, for instance, and so I never work on lawns. And so what I encourage people to do and do quite frequently is lawn abatement. And so I'll come in and bring a bunch of cardboard and a bunch of free wood chips from tree trimmers, and so they win and I win because I get the free mulch, and they win because they don't have to take it to the dump and get charged money. And so I smother out lawns with wood chips and then plant the natives into them. And so it's, instead of an ornamental lawn, they have a functional habitat, a whole little ecology developing quite easily with taking waste resources and transforming them into food for the worms and for the plants. And so that's kind of the native aspect. And then the edible aspect is getting people to grow their own food. And so many urban people are divorced from where their food comes from and think that it all comes from Safeway, and that's just how it is. And well, you know, we can really grow so much. We have a 12-month growing season here in the Bay Area, and so I grow tomatoes and lettuce and broccoli and carrots and lots of fruit trees and real interesting kinds of things like strawberry guavas and pineapple guavas and lemon guavas and chayote and all these crazy perennial things that are kind of take some education to get people to know how to eat them, but it's really easy. And so lots of perennial edibles and some annuals that reseed themselves a lot, like lettuces and chard. And so a lot of the seed saving I do is actually in other people's yards, and so that's why the landscaping business has been a long-term successful thing.
You've been mentioning a few different things. Let me try to pin down some definitions for people who might not be familiar. Maybe if we could start off by talking about what, if you could define permaculture.
Yeah, permaculture, you could think about it as designing for sustainable human settlements, and the name permaculture comes from Australia in the 70s with two folks, David Holmgren and Bill Mollison, and they coined the term permaculture. Back then, they were thinking of permanent agriculture, and now it's kind of come to mean something a little bit different, more of permanent culture. So permaculture is not just for gardeners, it's also for architects. We try to incorporate natural building using local resources like sand and clay and straw, things like that, to build buildings. So cob would be something that you could build, or straw bale homes could be part of permaculture, and using energy as a part of your system. So passive solar heating and solar heating your water with solar energy and photovoltaics and all those kinds of things are part of it. And, you know, animals and agriculture and permaculture systems are important. I have 6 chickens and 2 ducks in my backyard, and I'm going to be getting some beehives. So it's, like I said, not just plants and stuff, and it's just a design system that's based on natural systems thinking. So it's an ecological lens to look at the world and try to fit in anything from architecture to economics to raising kids to growing plants. So it's just a wide-ranging tool that's kind of an indigenous knowledge.
And how about urban agriculture? How would you define that, and, you know, sort of how are you involved in it in the Bay Area?
Yeah, urban agriculture is a lot of community gardens, school gardens, homeless gardens, any kind of youth garden. So there's a number of organizations that are doing this kind of thing, like People's Grocery in West Oakland or BYA in Berkeley and things like that. It's school gardens and community gardens, any of that kind of thing. And so it's just people growing food. So it could just be a backyard garden. It could really be anything. So it's just people being in touch with where their food comes from, so knowing the seasons of availability of food so we have less transportation miles. Because I'm sure you've talked about this, or you will in your shows, but the average vegetable or fruit is traveling 1,500 miles, and we could grow it right in our backyards or on our decks or balconies or rooftops or whatever.
So what can someone who has no yard to garden in, what can they do to grow their own food?
Well, if they have any kind of deck or balcony space, if they don't have any earth in their backyard, like a lot of apartment dwellers. Looking out my yard, there's an apartment building, and some of the neighbors there have grown things in containers, so any kinds of nursery pots, wooden boxes, you could even get dresser drawers and all kinds of salvaged containers and stuff, and just start growing some herbs on your balcony or on a fire escape or on a roof. I know people that take 5-gallon buckets and drill holes in them and grow tomatoes on roofs, and so you don't have to have a garden to be able to grow something. You could use wine barrels, and just really you can be very creative and use scrap wood and build little boxes, and so you can grow quite a bit of food in a small space. That's one suggestion. And community gardens, so if you don't have your own land, you might find a neighborhood community garden. The Oakland Parks and Rec Department has community gardens, and there's the Berkeley Gardening Collaborative, where there's a whole network of community gardens to get involved with. And start your own is another one. That there might be a vacant lot, or some neighbor might have a big yard and might not be a gardener but might be interested in, like my neighbor, I've got two houses right next to me, and neither neighbor was really doing any gardening, and so I proposed then that we tear down the fences and grow a bunch of food together, and they actually went for it, and so I've got all these cover crops in right now, and I'm in the process of going to be cutting them down soon and growing a bunch of tomatoes, and then all three neighbors will get to share them. So that was a creative solution, that I don't have enough space in my yard for all the projects that I can conceive of and actually make happen, and so I needed to expand. And getting to know my neighbors is a real important thing about sustainability and food security, really. So think beyond your own boundaries.
So if I could just ask you one last question. This week's show is about eating and drinking to save the world. So I'm wondering how you think we affect the world by what we choose to grow in our gardens, or what can we do to change the world through what we eat?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I think that's really important. Kind of taking some of the permaculture principles and applying them, seeing what we have growing in our yards. So many of us were so divorced from our food system, I think it becomes very political. I think we can really transform the world if we simply take out the ivy and rose bushes and lawns and juniper hedges and whatnot that people have mostly growing in their yards. You know, say 95% of stuff people are growing in their yards is generally ornamental, and that's fine to have beauty and pretty stuff, but I find so much beauty in the edibles, and of course the natives have so much more habitat value. So if you're trying to grow something just for purely functional, something that's beautiful, you might as well help save an endangered swallowtail butterfly by planting a yampa, something like that. You know, there's just connections that are millions of years old that we can help recreate by what we choose. But I think not just natives, but I think growing our food, so chopping down ivy and, you know, smothering grass and whatnot, because it takes so much water and so much energy, and instead growing our food just becomes such a wonderful thing of how we can change the world. So all of a sudden, not needing to transport the vegetables, because it takes 6 times as much petroleum to take some vegetables that are grown in, say, the Central Valley and eat them versus stuff that we just grow in our own yard. So if we can eliminate petroleum use in what we're doing with our landscapes, then all of a sudden we don't have to have foreign wars and all these kinds of things. So I think it can become very political about what we grow and how we grow it. And another example would be on my fence. I've planted some Chinese spinach and some chayote and some tree collards. And so I live in a very racially diverse neighborhood here in the Fruitvale area. And so the collard greens, I have a lot of African Americans that come by and harvest them, and I've got Laotian and Mien and Cambodian Vietnamese people that eat the Chinese spinach, and you know, the chayote, the Latin American folks and Asian folks eat that, and so all of a sudden my fence has become a neighborhood commons. It's all edible, and so I think that's a really great thing that people can do, is plant food for other people than just themselves.
If I want to help anybody in the world before I die, if I want the suffering all around us to subside, I have got to be more conscious of the things I do and don't do. Every little seed in time will flower. Plant the ones that lead me down a path toward really helping. I am the garden, but I'm also the gardener.
That's it for this week's show on eating and drinking to save the world. Please check back next week when we go back in time to glorious Georgian England and talk to food history experts about bringing the tastes of the 1700s into our own contemporary culinary lives. We'll check out some old cookbooks, have a bit of game, and discover a wonderful spring dessert, syllabub. The song Homebrewer is by Matt Dillon and Amame by Laura Garcia, both from GarageBand. The song Gardener is from Rebecca Riots at RebeccaRiots.com. Thanks to Daniel Foster for delivering the podcast to the world and for generally putting up with me, and to Shane Rhodes for scouring the world to find the great culinary world savers. And thanks to all of you for putting us on your iPod and coming to the Eat, Feed, Sound kitchen to cook with us.